To support our work at the Izzy and Murtada Picture Show and the work of other independent creators like us, sign up to listen to the podcast on Nebula. Nebula is the creator-owned streaming platform that hosts great videos and podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Sign up today at nebula.tv/pictureshow and you'll get access to this podcast plus other great podcasts and videos. Sign up at Nebula and help support independent media creators. That's nebula.tv/pictureshow. I'm Izzy.
And I'm Murtada, and this is the Izzy and Murtada Picture Show, or as we're calling it this week, the Sandra Hüller Hour.
Oh my God, don't even get me started. Like, I knew we were going to talk about it, but you really just dove right in.
Yes, so out in cinemas this week is Anatomy of a Fall, the movie that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes that we both just saw at the New York Film Festival, starring the wonderful Sandra Hüller in what I think is like perhaps the performance of the year. Like, I haven't seen everything, obviously, but you know, I've seen Poor Things and Killers of the Flower Moon, and those are the two other sort of like best actress contenders, and this might be my favorite of the three, just performance wise but we'll dig deep into the film too.
That's good. I haven't seen either of those yet, but from what I've seen this year, yes, I would agree with that.
Oh, we did see Maestro. That also has a best actress contender.
Weird how I forgot about that.
It's also a very, like, all those performances are very, very good. Like, all four that I mentioned are really performances that will be, you know, will probably get nominated and will be deserved nominees. But let's talk about Anatomy of a Fall. So this movie is Justine Treat. I used to call her Justine Treat, but at the screening, I think Dennis Lim said Justine Triet. So let's go with that.
I think it's really funny. This is a total side note, but I think it's really funny how, like, clearly a majority of the programmers at the New York Film Festival or Film at Lincoln Center speak French. Because every time they say a French name, like, they say it the way they should be saying it, you know?
Like, they're all,
yes, today we're going to be talking to Justine Triet. And you're just like, oh my God, okay.
They're all Francophiles and French speakers, yes. So Justine Triet, who won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. This is, I think, her maybe third or fourth film, but I've only seen Sybil, which starred Virginie Efira, but had Sandra Hüller in a very small role. So at the premiere at New York Film Festival, she came out with her co-screenwriter and with Sandra, and she said, "I wrote this with him for her." And the character is even called Sandra, so it's definitely written for her. And she's German, living in France, so they kind of tailor-made it for her. And she mostly speaks English in this film, which is kind of surprising for like a French film set in France and taking mostly, it's a courtroom drama. So she's in court, but then she's like, I need to speak in English because I don't know French that well. But anyway,
I can offer some insight from the Q&A on that topic if we want to go there.
Yes, do it. Yeah, we could do that and then delve into the film. Yeah.
Okay. So I went to the free talk hosted by New York Film Festival that featured Sandra Hüller, who is in a couple of films. She's also in Zone of Interest. So they were kind of interested in thinking about her as an actress, which I think is appropriate because she'll probably have a big year this year. And she was talking about how she met Justine Triet and how the two of them kind of came to be working together. But coincidentally, Sandra Hüller didn't speak any French at all until about like 3 months before she was approached for this film. She was just like looking for a hobby basically and started taking French lessons. I think she had taken some like in high school or something. But like, yeah, it was just like a happy coincidence that she had approached her with this script that had a lot of French in it. So, but she really had to like focus kind of like to learn whatever French was in the script. She wasn't quite at that level yet. But I thought that was interesting how sort of coincidental, but also like kind of forced her hand a little bit to
Yes.
learn that language quickly.
So then it's funny that in the film when she's always like, they're always telling her to speak in French. And she kind of can't, which is funny. It's like a running, it's not a joke because this movie is very serious, but it's kind of a running thing in the film. So Anatomy of a Fall starts with a fantastic scene. I'm not going to give up the scene, but basically it's about a family. They live somewhere in the Alps, close to Grenoble. It's Sandra is, she's a writer. Her husband is also a writer. She's more successful. They have a son, maybe about 11, 12, who had an accident a few years before the movie takes place and was blinded as a result of that accident. The movie starts with something happens and the dad falls. It's in the title, so it's not a spoiler. He falls from like the third floor, hits his head and dies. And the film is, did he commit suicide? Did he fall? Did she kill him? And that's sort of like a way for them to dissect this relationship and marriage in general and how people who are married for a long time, things change and allegiances become different and you feel differently about the person you're with and they feel differently about you, and what started as love might become competition, might become something else, even maybe murder. And so the funniest thing is that she wrote it with her, I'm not sure if they're legally married, but they're definitely a couple. So she wrote it with her other half, for lack of a better term. I hate that word, but with whoever she shares her life with. And it was very funny because at the introduction, they said something like, she joked, he's like, well, we did write it together. It was hard, but you know, he's still alive.
That's funny. I feel like the best stories about couples are written by couples and like good mm-hmm. couples.
Yes.
Thinking about like Ruth Gordon, you know, and what's his name? You know who I'm talking about.
Yes. I can't remember his name either.
Garson Kanin.
Garson Kanin. Yes. I mean, in this, they sort of write a story about a couple who might be in combat. They're basically in the combat part of their marriage, where he's frustrated because his writing is not happening. They're obviously both grieving what happened to their son and trying to overcome that. And she is openly bisexual, as the prosecutor in the film keeps reminding everyone, which is a very misogynist sort of like sexist thing to keep saying, oh, she fucks around. So she fucks around. Which,
yeah, biphobic too.
Yeah, good for her.
An execution or an accusation often lobbied at bisexual people.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things are happening, and you get sort of like a tense 2.5 hours where this marriage, this relationship with between the husband and wife and with their son is sort of dissected by strangers in a courtroom. And the movie is just, I felt it was like scalpel sharp about the marriage and about the French legal system, or the way they sort of like put people on trial. I found it very fascinating that the witness can come up and then the defendant can like interrupt the witness while they're giving their testimony and say stuff and vice versa. It makes it more theatrical, more dramatic than sort of like American courtrooms where everybody has to ask permission before they mm-hmm. speak. And then of course there's like Sandra Hüller at the center of it all. So tell me first, is it kind of like your thoughts about the film itself? Because I think we both like it.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved the ambiguity of it, and how it kind of painted a really clear picture of two people who were really flawed, but mm-hmm. also you can find like sympathy or understand maybe like why they're making the wrong decision, or why they might react negatively to things. Like I don't think it ever makes anybody out to be like a full on villain, which mm-hmm. I really liked.
But also, before you move on, I just want to add to what you said, but also you can understand all three points of view that the film sort of presents, that she could have killed him. There's enough there for us to believe that. There's also enough for us to believe that he could have killed himself. Or fell, maybe. That's like the lesser of the three in the end. But yeah, that's what I loved about the film, is that you're always questioning. I mean, like in every scene, it's sort of like, oh.
You kind of change your mind over the course of the film.
Yes.
Like several times.
Yes, yeah. You hit it on the nail. Yes.
And I think what was interesting hearing her talk about it was like, she really wanted the clarity for it to sort of like understand, okay, if I'm playing this character, I need to know what, like what she did and what happened. And Trier basically told her, like, what you need to act this as if you are, like, you believe you're innocent. Like, that's what the character believes. So like, you should believe that. But that doesn't mean like she's not lying. You know what I mean? Like, there's still, there really isn't any clarity. And I don't think what there is ever going to be an answer, but I like that. And I think in a way, like, I think it reminds me of Parasite in the sense that, not in like the actual film of it, but I can see it becoming a film that like the average film goer would enjoy, because there, it has enough momentum to like keep it entertaining, but it's also something that you can really spend hours like talking about with your friends and being like, oh, well, I thought she was like this. And she, you know, when she said that, it didn't come off too well to me. You know, you could spend so long dissecting it. And like, it's kind of a, not a crowd pleaser, because it's not that kind of movie exactly, but it's an enjoyable experience as an audience member to kind of be taken on that roller coaster.
Absolutely, because the filmmaking is so great. And also, like, you said it's not a crowd pleaser, but there is one scene that I think is a crowd pleaser, the big fight, because they fight and it's a huge, long, maybe 20 minute fight, something like that. It's really long, and it just starts and sort of like keeps building up and then it boils over, and then it becomes, and the way it's presented sort of as a flashback. So it's later in the film, but also it's presented while she's listening to how people in the courtroom are interpreting it, from the jury to the prosecutor to her defense lawyer to everybody. So it just gives that fight, which to me was the centerpiece, the crowd, let's call it the crowd pleasing centerpiece.
Yeah,
because that,
yeah.
You know, it's as if you're watching Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf or whatever, but
like in a reality show format, kind of.
Yes.
It's like, yeah, exactly. That fight was so interesting to me. And I wonder, I don't know, this might be like a little bit of a spoiler, so I don't know. Plug your ears if you're worried. But that fight really put me on her side. I don't know if that was like a universal reaction, but there were several points during that fight where I was like, that's right.
Yeah. She made
you speak English.
She made more sense than he did. Like, you could see she was right about things, and he was just frustrated about
he was a little hurt and flashing
so I think, you know, but that's the thing about this film, like that fight maybe might put you in her side, but like you said earlier, there are other scenes where you're on
sometimes
his side.
The math doesn't math, you know what I mean?
Exactly, because she's also such a prickly character, and Sandra Hüller plays her in this way where that she's giving you enough to make you intrigued, but she's not giving you everything, because she keeps like, you're not sure, is she like her relationship with her son, which is not really that sort of like outwardly loving and maternal. It's she's somebody who like treats him like an adult. And so when she explains why she does that, you're kind of be like, oh, I get it now. But also sometimes you just feel like there is a coldness between them, and maybe they don't enjoy being in each other's company, which also sort of adds, because he becomes the pivotal witness in the movie, so then it sort of adds to the fact that he holds the cards. Is he going to take her side or his dad's side? But also his dad is dead, and he might want one parent to be with him, so even if it is the parent he doesn't prefer.
I think like there's a certain type of person who prefers privacy, and like asks for boundaries and all that kind of thing, which is like totally normal, but like who also is unable to see like when that becomes a problem. And that's kind of who she is as a character. Like she's still trying to maintain a level of privacy in a situation that like absolutely requires full mm-hmm. honesty and transparency. And she's yes. like kind of incapable of seeing that kind of like something has shifted. And I think like that kind of like she is a very emotionally intelligent character, kind of except when she's not. Yes. Like there are times when you're just kind of like, oh, you're not, you don't understand what's happening. And yeah. I really like that. I just think Cassandra Hohler's performance in that way is really, really delicate and really refined, the way that she can kind of like flip those little switches on and off where you can kind of see like what someone, what she does understand or what she doesn't understand. Is so like in her face. It's not even necessarily in the script all the time.
Yeah, totally. And it's just the way that she sort of is around everybody else. Like you sort of don't understand. The movie sort of hints like at a history between her and her defense lawyer, but you mm-hmm. never know. Like, is she sort of trying to use that history so he can get her off, or does she genuinely see him as a friend, perhaps somebody she flirted with long time ago or not? Yeah. Her motivations are never clear. They're always very mercenary, like you feel, even yeah. with her son, with her lawyer, with everybody around her. There's a, because she is presented as this sort of person who uses everything in her life to write about her books. Like she used her relationship with her parents, with her husband. She even stole one of his ideas and made it a best-selling book. So she is a mercenary emotionally. Mm-hmm. And that makes her just so fascinating to watch and makes the performance so fun. Like you don't want it to be clear, and what both the script does and the performance particularly does is that it makes it ambiguous, it makes it fascinating to watch. I've seen it twice, and I had different feelings about her each time.
Interesting. Yeah. That's why I'm excited to see it again.
Like I was more sympathetic to her in the first time, mm-hmm. and the second time I was like, she might have killed him.
Oh, totally. Yeah, she definitely might have. Here's one thing I really want to give this film credit for, which I think probably will go under discussed in all of this. And maybe this is just because like, this is me speaking, but I love that this is, it kind of like weaponizes her charm as an actor as well. Like, I don't think, my impression of Sandra Hohler like before this was never like, oh, this is like a really flirtatious woman. Like she's not that kind of actor. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But sometimes like something, I've watched a couple of her movies like since I saw Anatomy of a Fall. And one mm-hmm. thing that kind of comes up again and again is like, if she wants to turn it on,
she can,
for a seduction, she absolutely can. Mm-hmm. And I think that is weaponized so well in this film. Like in the first scene, the way that she's talking to that academic, the way she kind of talks to the lawyer, mm-hmm. like there's just something that she has where she can kind of like grab somebody and just kind of like render them kind of unsure of how to respond because like they're being hit on like so aggressively.
Yes, totally.
And so you're just like, oh my God, like it is very, you know, potent with her. And so I feel like that wouldn't be possible to see in the script without someone like her in that role.
Yeah. And this is, I think, also when a director, writer writes a part for an actor, they tailor it for like, yeah. If not for them, but for their idea of them. And so mm-hmm. then it becomes sort of like the part itself becomes the conversation that leads to the performance. And this is obviously so tailor made for her.
Yeah.
Besides, like you pointed out, the sort of like, not the surface stuff, the language, the background, whatever, that's all surface stuff. So she can actually say the words, whatever. But what you were just talking about is the acting, the actual stuff of why she was cast, so that she can convey all these different things.
Yeah, like I was just watching, last night I watched In the Isles, which is from, I think, like 2016 or so, with Fran Sergowski. And there's a scene where she, like, the two of them just like are flirting throughout this whole movie, but it's like their first interaction, and she walks in and she's like, "Aren't you gonna invite me to coffee?" or something like that. And I was like, if someone flirted with me like that, I would barf. Like, it was so, like, in a good way. I was like, this is so charismatic. I was like, that rude. This is so rude. But I'm glad it's like picking up on those little things about like what she's capable of doing and kind of replicating it. Like, it's just so smart.
Yeah. Yeah. She's wonderful. And she's having like a big year. I think like it's been brewing for her since Tony Erdman, which was such a big sort of hit on the sort of like non-English language circuit. And then she made all these sort of like smaller parts in different movies. But this year, I have seen her in three movies besides Anatomy of a Fall and The Zone of Interest. There's also a movie she made called Cece and I. And this is sort of like, it's the same story that Vicky Creeps did last year with Scorsage. So it's about that
but
empress.
She's like the lady in waiting.
She's the lady in waiting, yes. And the movie sort of has these queer undertones for the relationship, which I think is something she brings to a lot of her roles, which is probably why we both like her. And I think in The Zone of Interest, she is effective, but she's more like in service of the story there. Like, it's not a performance. The movie's not about the performances. It's about other things. Like, she does well in what she's like, she acts, she does the job well, but it's also, it's a sort of performance, just the way she's filmed and all these shots from far away and whatever, you never sort of see her face that much. It's not about that, you know, it's about other, the way that that film is made is not to draw your attention to the performance or for you to like the performance or be moved by it or whatever it is. It's about all of them working together to deliver a particular thesis on the Holocaust. So this is the one, I think, Anatomy of the Fall is the showcase. And even though the character is so prickly, you just are so amazed by her. Like, you're like, you know, she's somebody who would definitely stab you in the back, will steal your ideas, put your conversation in her book, all of these things, which makes her just so fascinating to watch.
Yeah, and thinking about like what a person like that would do isolated basically from any community.
Yes.
In the mountains, just stewing and getting angry and frustrated and all of that kind of stuff. I do think, going back to Zone of Interest really quickly, this is something that was really interesting to me in the Q&A. I think we might have talked about this, how it's just like, it kind of just sucks for like every German actor at one point will like have to play a Nazi. It's just kind of, you know,
the rite of passage. Period.
Yeah, exactly. And she was very specific about why she decided to do that, because she'd never done that before. And she was very firm about saying, like, playing a fascist doesn't interest me. I don't want to bring humanity to any of these people. And just like the way she spoke about it, I think I'm very curious about how this is discussed, like, amongst actors in Germany, because someone in the audience asked her, like, okay, well, you know, like, how did you feel like playing this woman who was doing very bad things or who was very complacent, but who also was like a mother, like just trying to take care of her family? And she was like, I didn't think about it that way at all. Like, this woman's a monster. There's no way you can be a good mother or a good person and like do the things that this woman did.
Well, she certainly didn't play her as a good mother. I think neither of those women are good mothers.
Yeah. Okay. True. But, but I think that's interesting. It's like, there's no, I feel like if you had asked an American woman that or an American actress, like, there would have been some kind of like, oh, I just tried to like find the humanity or like put myself in her shoes or like these, that kind of like empathetic, like stretching that people try to do with these characters. But like with Germans, they seem very clear about how they're going to approach these things and be like, absolutely not, like, this is a monster.
not to this Meryl Streep, who is the most American and the greatest of American actresses, but she did do that with Thatcher, which I'm like, I don't need to see a humanized Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, exactly.
But she did.
It's
it.
Like, why? Like, why? You know, there, you don't have to do that. And I found that really refreshing and also just like very I don't know. I just really appreciated the clarity of it and how like it felt very political for her. And she was like, I didn't take this movie because I thought this role was interesting. I took the movie because of what like Jonathan Glazer was trying to say with it.
Yeah. And I think that's also sort of, if you see these two performances and if you see these two movies, she is one of those actors who puts their talent in the service of what the filmmaker wants to do or wants to accomplish. And it's very sort of obvious in these two movies, because to the point that you were making, she's very different in them. And in, I felt everything in The Zone of Interest was in the service of the vision of telling the story. And the same thing in Anatomy of a Fall, is just the vision is different and the performance and how it manifests is different. Because of Anatomy of a Fall is sort of a complex character study. It's of two characters, basically her and the son, and sort of how they react to this murder. And so then the focus is on the performance. The focus is on her face. The focus is on sort of the way she holds herself in court. I mean, I saw all those scenes where she's in court and you can sort of feel her fear that this could end with her being, you know, indicted for her husband's murder, but also sort of a little bit of cruelty, a little bit of like arrogance, is like, oh, this these idiots around me, how dare they put me on trial, like I'm smarter than anybody here. And that so manifests in just the way she would talk and would look at other people, like you could see those boastings playing on her face.
It's kind of like she's parenting the jury a little bit.
Yes.
Because she's kind of like, here's a very like simple nuanced concept that I have to explain to you like a child, because like people are dumb.
Yes, exactly. That's her attitude. Her attitude is people are dumb and I'm the smartest person in this and any room.
Also, she's kind of right. Like most of the things she explained, I was like, yeah, people should be able to see that. But like, are they going to in this situation? I'm not so sure, you know?
Yeah. Which is to your point earlier, that why in that fight you take her side, because she is able to like eloquently and clearly tell you exactly what the situation is. Even though, you know, her husband is trying to spin it different ways, she's the one with the clarity and has sort of like the clarity of mind to just pinpoint exactly what's going on, as opposed to all the emotions and all the other things which are always part of, you know,
she's
fights
a good writer.
In a marriage. Yes, exactly. she's a great actress. She's a good writer. I think the script is wonderful. I can't believe how like economical, to the point. Also, it's I say economical, but it is 2.5 hours and I would have sat for more. Just wanted to get a little bit more. And all the characters, I know we talked about her and the son, but like the woman appointed by the court to sort of like sit with the son because he's a witness is such a fascinating character, and she gets like a big scene where like she maybe changes everything, and the stupid prosecutor, you get him to, even though he's kind of obnoxious, and her lawyer who sort of maybe has a crush on her, maybe the, like all these characters are amazing. It's so well written.
Yeah, it's so good. It's so good. I was just thinking, sorry, this goes back to what we were just talking about before was Zone of Interest, but I was thinking about the monologue in May, December, where Natalie Portman was like, well, isn't it fun to play like bad people sometimes? And like, that's exactly it. Like that's how Americans are. Anyway, sorry, that just reminded me of that quickly.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. Anatomy of a Fall is so well written. Tony Erdman, I think I also really, really enjoyed that movie when it came out, and then I just rewatched it again recently. I think they're making an American version of it.
Oh, yeah, I think that is not happening. They've been trying to make it for like 10 years now since Tony Erdman came out. I don't even know. I don't think it has been 10 years yet, but basically since it came out. It was going to be Lena Dunham. It was going to be Jack Nicholson. It was going to be Kristen Wiig. It's never happening, I don't think.
I just found out, I just realized this because I was looking up Will Ferrell's IMDb.
And he's a producer on it.
Yeah, because he's listed as a producer. Because I was like, I think his producing career is really interesting. Like seeing that he was a producer of May, December is just like, why? Yes. You know, but I'm just good for him.
And Vice. Or is it like, no, Succession. The other Succession? Yeah, he's very, yeah, he's doing well as a producer.
Yeah, I'm just like, what are you doing? I mean, that's really cool, but I never would have expected, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
Anyways, but yeah, I just saw that listed.
Yeah, I don't think that's happening. But anyway, I think this is Sandra Hüller's year. And I think, you know, we can touch a little bit on the other movies at NYFF very briefly. Like, I was thinking the other day of composing a tweet, and then I was like, Murtada, who gives a shit? Nobody reads tweets anymore. But I'll say my tweet here. I apologize that I'm mentioning Twitter. But I was thinking about the movies I saw. Like, I think Anatomy of the Fall is one that's sort of like the intellectual one. And All of Us Strangers is the one about all the emotions, and mm-hmm. the taste of things, is the one where I just had the most joy watching it. And so it's very good that, in such a short period, you can just be stimulated so differently by so many different movies, and that it's hard for them to come up and say which one is my favorite. And that's mm-hmm. sort of like what a festival is supposed to do. I think we're also supposed to find trends, and I think you found one, which we mm-hmm. can, you know, talk about a little bit, and talk about a couple of other movies that we saw this week. What did you think? Do you think like this Anatomy of a Fall was the most intellectual film you saw, one that sort of like just demanded a little bit of your mind while you were watching it?
I wouldn't use the word intellectual. I think mm-hmm. I was the most engrossed in it,
mm-hmm.
perhaps, of all the films that I saw. But I didn't feel like I was necessarily like challenged with a concept that I hadn't really considered before. Like, in that way, maybe maybe Zone of Interest would have been.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, I mean, I don't think that that is necessarily a complex concept, what he's trying to do there, but I feel like it was just kind of expressed in a way that I thought was really well executed.
Yeah.
I
think when I said intellectual, I was maybe more in meaning more that as I was watching, I kept have to think. Like, I felt like I needed to think about, you know, I need to think about this marriage. I needed to think about the French legal system. I needed to think about misogyny of prosecutors. I needed to think about, like, and then the most obvious question, did she do it or did she not? There was that's
sure.
kind of what I meant.
Yes. I would agree with that. I think Evil Does Not Exist is kind of like closer to, yes. is also like up there with that, which is the Hamaguchi film, which is basically about this company that wants to open a glamping site, glamorous camping, for those of you who may not know what that is.
Such a funny thing to say, but it's very serious in the film.
But they want to open a glamping area in this like remote town near, like within a drivable distance of Tokyo, I think, that is very like in touch with nature and very reliant on its natural resources. And obviously, like, they just want to come in and ruin the community. And so I thought like the way that was executed really like was very quiet. Like, it's not as chatty as as Anatomy of a Fall is, which like, I love chatty movies, so you know, that was kind of more in my wheelhouse, but like, I think it does a similarly excellent job of kind of like laying out showing you like what different people's motivations are and like how all of those are kind of coming into conflict and maybe like forcing people into decisions that they are not good decisions, but maybe like are understandable ones, you know?
Totally. And I think it also goes beyond the sort of like, did they or did they not do this in Anatomy of a Fall, to be like,
yeah,
did they do it? But also, what did they do? There are a lot of questions at the end. Also, what I like about Hamaguchi's movies is that I think they're kind of like religious texts. Like, in there is always clarity, even if the story is ambiguous, like you always sort of know where side you're on morally. And this is a compliment. Even coming from an atheist like me, I do understand the sort of like, you know, religious texts are morally not that complex, but also they derive their strength from being grandiose and vast and dealing with all the big moral questions. And he does that too. And this is kind of what I like about his films.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Yeah, in terms of, I was trying to think of like how I would rank things that I saw this year.
It's hard.
It's really hard. There's a lot of good stuff. I will say, like, I think, so this is my first festival as like quote unquote press, or like having a press pass with contemporary films. And in past years, when I've like been on Twitter and witnessed a lot of like, you know, festival reactions and stuff like that, mm-hmm. you get this, like, some of the things that people say about these films during a festival, you're just like, this is absurd. And there's always kind of a course correction, like when the film actually comes out and people, like more people see it and they're like, what the fuck were you talking about? It's not the best movie you've ever seen. It's not revolutionary, whatever. And like, I've seen some of that this year, but I also think, like I've seen some things about Priscilla and about Maestro and, you know, other things where I'm just like, people are going to read these tweets in a couple months and be like, what are you talking? Like, you know?
Whatever. Yeah.
It's overhyped, but
not Anatomy of a Fall.
not Anatomy of a Fall. But I also think like, truly this is kind of like an exceptional lineup in like a way that we haven't seen in a really long time. In a like diverse way we haven't seen in a long time. Like there's no just like one heavy hitter from a auteur, and the rest of it is like seemingly filler. no offense yeah. But yeah. You know what I mean, where it's just like there's just so much and like of different types of films that like I really think anyone could have come to this festival and found something that they like.
Absolutely.
Even if it's, you know, something like Hitman, like it's the most like broadly appealing film that I've seen in a really long time, you know. So yeah, I don't know. It's just really exciting. And I feel really blessed that I got to be here for this one specifically.
Yeah, it is a fantastic lineup. And it's just so amazing to just be like 2 weeks of like banger after banger. I mean, not all of them have been bangers. There've been a few clunkers or let's say not that many, like maybe a couple. But I'm going to actually tell a story. It's not really a clunker because I think the film is good. But I, for the first time ever, I walked out of a movie at the New York Film Festival. I think the last movie I've ever walked up was when Chris Pine made a Jack Ryan movie. But that movie was so bad. It deserved.
Why were you even there?
I don't know why. Maybe I was invited to a screening, so I went, but I walked out. I'm like, this is terrible. But anyway, I did walk out of Green Border, the Polish film by Agnieszka Holland, because it's a story about this family of Syrian refugees crossing the border from Belarus into Poland, and they meet a woman from Afghanistan, and so they all sort of form, and then they meet other refugees who are trying to cross the border. And it is so relentless in its sort of I would say true depiction of what happens to refugees at borders, but also I just, you know, I couldn't deal with it. Like I kept thinking of what happened to my family this year, to my mom. I kept seeing my aunt who had to cross the border, and their border crossing was not like as treacherous or as filled with danger and bullets and cold and rain as it is between Poland and Belarus. It was you know, in the Sahara in summer or spring. So it wasn't, the conditions were better. The crossing itself was not dangerous at all. They were never in danger of, but also I just couldn't resist feeling the thing of like leaving your life behind and not knowing where you're going to about what that's going to mean, but also being in a perilous journey while you're dealing with all of that. And so I was with my friend Ren, and she kind of noticed that I was flinching. You know, and she said, you know, we can leave if you want. And I appreciated that because it's sort of like, I just thought I could just sit here for the next 2 hours and feel terrible. And then I was like, you know what? I don't need to. I know what this movie is trying to say, and it's important to be said, and there's an audience for it. And I hope people watch the film, but maybe today at this time, not for me. Yeah. And so, you know, I thought of that and I wanted to tell the story because I was just think we've seen so many powerful movies And you want to watch them and you want to be enthralled and you want to be moved and you want to, you know, think about who did it and all of that. But also sometimes the film can be so powerful that you can't see it. And you just have to walk out. So now I have more respect, more patience, more appreciation of people who walk out of movies. Not bad. Not because they're bad, but because they just couldn't deal with it.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think there's a difference between like having a harrowing experience that you're personally thinking about and being like, I think Bleat is inappropriate, because I did see people walk out of Bleat.
Did it have like naked
people? It's a half hour long. Yes.
Okay, that's
a half hour long. Sit there, you know what I mean? Anyway, yeah. But no, that I think that story is fantastic, and I'm really like happy that you did that. Like, I don't know, I think it just shows such maturity to kind of recognize like where your boundaries are, mm-hmm. and to say like, actually, I'm gonna protect myself here because I don't need to expose myself to things that are gonna hurt me.
Yes.
And that's really great.
But anyway, Anatomy of a Fall is, mm-hmm. you have to go see it. It's out, I think everywhere, I'm not sure. I keep getting emails about it, so I just assume it's out everywhere. But I think at least if you're in the big cities in America, you should be able to see it. And if not, you will be able to see it, because this is a film and a performance that I think will be talked about forever. She already got a cover, I think, in The Hollywood Reporter as Actress of the Year, which is kind of ridiculous because that was August when that cover was released. But also people have seen her movies at Cannes and whatever. So fine. But I think it's definitely sort of playing in that sort of like, this is the performance, this is the arrival of a new generational talent, of someone you're gonna be watching for the next 10-20 years.
It feels weird to say that now.
Yes.
She has like 30 films under her belt, you know.
Totally, but not as like sort of like the center of, and as a star in a Palme d'Or winning thing, and also like sort of like crossing over, like America's big. America is a big thing, and this is sort of like, it's not her debut in America because she's done Tony Erdmann, which was well liked and respected and all of that, mm-hmm. but it's also sort of like her sort of first time being at the center of a movie and being the sort of main attraction, because I think the marketing campaign, which that cover definitely was part of, is all about her. So definitely someone is trying to get Heather Oscar nomination, and I think she deserves it.
I am surprised that she did not win the Best Actress Award at Cannes.
Well, they can't. The rule is that if you win one of the two big awards, you can't win another award. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yes.
Rude. Change the rule. Changed the role for Sandra.
I think somebody made it bad for people, because there was one year when they gave one movie like four awards, and then they changed the rule immediately. Like, you can't do that anymore. You have to spread the wealth. Yeah.
Boo. Yeah, I didn't know that. That's wild.
Yes.
But also, I don't pay that much attention to Cannes, to be honest.
Yes. I do a little bit. I know the rules. And I think it's the same reason that Emma Stone didn't win Best Actress at Venice, because Poor Things won the Golden Lion.
I was surprised, having seen Priscilla, that Kaylee Spaney won that award.
Yeah, I think she was second choice. It's just because the other movie didn't win.
My God.
They're like, can we give the movie Best Actress and Best Film? They're like, no. They're like, all right, Kaylee Spaney.
Who won? Were there directing awards at Venice?
Yes, I think Hamaguchi won second place. Mm. I'm not sure who won director. I can't remember now. Maybe it was a nice Gaholland for Green Board, or she was third. Someone like that. I don't know. But there is a directing award, and there is like 1, 2, 3 Golden Lion, Jury Prize, something, whatever. But so tell me about Priscilla. So I am not a Sofia Coppola acolyte. Like, one thing I appreciated about Priscilla is that there were so many young women in the lines, either in their ticket, mm-hmm. with their tickets, or in the standalone line. So she's certainly somebody who speaks to a generation. And to see sort of like that, some, you know, young people especially, who, you know, don't go to, or people, the media keeps telling us young people don't go to the movies as much. But anyway, these are younger people, and they were all standing in line waiting to see the Sofia Coppola movie. Like, I think that's great that she has that fan base. And even like looking at Twitter, I see a lot of people, just a lot of women in particular, being so in love with this film and with her. And that's good to see, even though I've never been, I love some of her movie. I think she's very talented, but I've never loved any of them. And I kind of didn't like a few. And this one kind of falls in the middle for me. But
I mean, I wouldn't say that I disagree with that overall assessment of Sofia Coppola. I mean, I would say I really like two or three of her films. I don't like two or three of her films. And this one is like in the middle.
Yeah, same.
I am writing a longer piece about this as like part of the critics program that I'm in. So look out for that if you are interested in hearing a little bit more. It's less about like how I feel about the film and more about how it kind of it's constructed and like the constraints that Sofia Coppola was working with and the choices that those constraints forced. But I would say that like the first half of this film is really, really successful in like painting a very specific and like
you can see the like G very, you can say the like, G root, the G word.
What?
Grooming.
Oh. Well, see, yeah, I think it's like not that simple, and I think that that's
it's not at all
really like successful about showing.
Yeah.
Like like it's really good at kind of like outlining the problem while also showing sympathy for like a young girl who of course would be like excited about like meeting her idol. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
like
totally.
it draws that line really, really well and like kind of shows how it's alluring, but also kind of a problem and nobody's really willing to step in. And then I think it kind of like starts falling apart when she needs to kind of grow up because the like the gilded cage just becomes a little too cagey, like too much of a cage, you know. Like there's not much else happening. So I think like if she were able to like bring that energy to the second half of it and like draw out Priscilla as an adult instead of like her teenage self, it would have been more successful to me.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of felt that it was just a little understated. Like I sort of got like exactly its thesis, like what it wants to tell us about Priscilla and about Elvis and about their relationship. But it was also really just, you know, it looked really cool and everything was like done really well. And it was beautiful. The images were beautiful, but the story itself was very understated. And in the end, I think that's sort of like Coppola's way. Like she's not somebody for louder emotions. Like the joke I said, I think I said it to you, is that, you know, there's a big fight in Maestro where Snoopy makes an appearance. And I said to you after the film, I think it's needed its Snoopy scene. And I was waiting like, for the big boil up and it never happened. But I guess that's not Coppola's way.
It's not like, I don't think really any of her main characters get monologues.
Yeah.
You know, in like, in a way that we kind of like traditionally associate, like, oh, this is the Oscar scene. Like the thing that we remember about Lost in Translation is like them whispering to each other and we don't even know what they're saying.
Exactly.
So it's kind of like that's more of her vibe, but also like in the process of writing this video, the article, I've been trying to like watch a lot of things about Priscilla, like the person, a lot of her interviews and stuff. And I think that's what's also really interesting is like, a lot of the things that I thought were really bizarre about some of the choices that she made like are actually that bizarre and like weird.
Like, so give us a tease. Give us an example.
So for example, like there's no blow up, right? So it is just kind of like you always kind of feel like Priscilla never turns the page where she's like resentful of Elvis. And I feel like it's kind of like a natural inclination to assume that like he was treating her this badly and The marriage was pretty unsuccessful. So like, why wouldn't, like, just a normal, like, logical person would be like, why wouldn't there be some kind of like blow up, or like, why wouldn't they be like estranged or something like that? But like the way that Priscilla talks about their relationship, she still loves him like years later. And she's just like, yeah, like, I'll always love him. Like, we just broke up and whatever. And it, like, it's very odd. Like, there's just the way that she talks about him, and like the way that he was, like, he never wanted to have sex with her and all of this stuff. Like, it's just strange. And there's no, it just doesn't seem like there were these moments that you kind of assume would be in a film like this.
Yeah.
So you're just, so it like makes for a strange story to begin with.
Yes.
And then like the execution on top of it just kind of makes it like, okay.
Yeah. So in a way it's refreshing, but also in a way it's undramatic. And yeah, there's nothing more dramatic than Elvis and Priscilla. Like, this has the makings of this big tragedy. A 14-year-old falls in love with the most famous man in the world. And they have a decades long relationship that's sort of where she was kind of his prisoner, basically.
Yeah.
But she never felt like there is so many ways to tell the story. And I just,
that's why the first half is interesting.
Yes.
It's like, that is the story. And then it just kind of like fizzles out.
And then it just becomes, I'm a woman, hear me roar, kind of, but also in the Sofia Coppola way of like very understated, like she's not roaring. She's just whispering that she's leaving.
She's looking out the window.
Yes. So.
But I mean, I think like people who love Sofia Coppola movies will get a lot out of it, in the sense that like all of the hallmarks of the things that she is typically praised for, or like that her fans love her for, are in this movie.
Yes, totally.
So like, if you're obsessed with her, like from her, from the filmography she has, then like you're probably
gonna love this.
To love it. Yeah,
yeah, totally. And the other thing I think that people is giving her praise for is that sort of like, this is the unvarnished story of Elvis, and it's not hagiographic in any way. It sort of shows him maybe in a truer light than he's ever been shown before, and that is true. But I just don't know if it's that interesting, like this new light on Elvis. Yeah, he did some bad things, but okay. But the thing is, never sort of like pushes it anywhere, like doesn't hit hard, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting, and what I'm kind of interested in comparing Priscilla and Maestro is like, like the insistence on analyzing these marriages that in many ways are like extremely conventional for like like show business couples.
Yeah.
Like, you know, women looking the other way for various reasons, either because like they're kind of forced. Well, they're usually forced to, but like, either because, you know, he's a rotten philanderer, or because like
he's a homosexual,
dudes. Yeah. yeah. So I don't know. It's just like, but there's also, it's like, once you kind of make that point, you kind of have to do something else with it. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can't just sit with that point for 2 hours. And I feel like we're kind of seeing that a lot. And so you just get like a back half of all of these movies that are just kind of dragging.
Totally. And I think Maestro is more in my wheelhouse. And at least we get the big fight. At least I get the actressing I want from both Bradley Cooper, who I always think of as an actress, not an actor, because he's, you know, he can give me the like the flourishes and the things, and he's not reticent like other male actors. And of course, from Carey Mulligan, who is really good in the film. And she's sort of like, you know, the top billing is not unwarranted. Like, it's like the scenes that leave an impact, even though the movie, it's a kind of a cold maestro, but it's kind of is about her character.
Yeah. I just think it's so funny. Like, this film cannot decide. It's like, it is only about Leonard Bernstein in the sense that like Bradley Cooper is playing Leonard Bernstein. And like, it wants you to think of him as being important.
It's surprisingly not about his work to such an extent. Like, I was just surprised. Like, there's maybe 2-3 scenes where his work is sort of front and center in a movie that's more than 2 hours long. Like, I was just very surprised by that approach. Like, I think somebody said it, and it's not me, but I believe it. Maybe it was you who said, you know, you get more of Leonard Bernstein in Tar than you do in Maestro.
Exactly. I mean, that was literally, okay, I really want to actually put this in the article because I do think Tar is a better biopic of Leonard Bernstein than Maestro is, because I think it actually, Maestro made me appreciate Tar more because of how smart the choice was to make Leonard Bernstein her mentor, and like the quirks about her character that are, like, are also in him as a person, mm-hmm. that I think aren't put into Maestro very much, hmm. you know. And so or like looking at, if you were to look at him as a mentor, it's like, you know, what does it mean to like craft an American classical music scene, like to be an American composer, and like what anxieties might that stir up? Well, then it makes sense when you think about like why Linda might change her name to like Lydia or change her last name, or like mm-hmm. trying to appeal to kind of a European sense of like norms that classical music has always wanted to fulfill.
Yeah.
Or like thinking about kind of his infidelities and kind of how free and like not predatory, but not predatory he was about.
I think he's pretty predatory.
Yeah. But feeling like entitled to that as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally.
Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, there, I do think that there are things about him that I think are just kind of underexplored.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
It's kind of disappointing. But, you know, it's not, I feel bad saying that, because it's like, oh, so you're saying that this like stories about domesticity or about women like aren't as important. And it's like, well, no, I just think Leonard Bernstein deserves more of a like dissection than he got.
I mean, I'll say it, like, for all Carrie Mulligan's efforts, and she is wonderful in the film, maybe this woman is not that interesting. Like, the most interesting thing about her, and maybe she is more interesting in real life, but the most interesting thing that this movie tells me about Felicia Montalguer is that she looked the other way while her husband had affairs with men.
Yeah, and
like that's
kind of
the only thing is of why there is a movie about her.
Yeah,
and I just don't think that's enough.
Yeah, if there is more interesting things to say about her, then I did not get that from this movie, and that's the screenplay's fault. That's the movie's fault. You know.
Yeah, I agree there, absolutely. But anyway, we're going to talk more about Priscilla and Maestro later in November when they're out, and we can talk more about it. I had very high expectations about Maestro. I still think Bradley Cooper is an interesting director. But A Star Is Born remains my favorite of his work. So that's...
Yep. We got 2 C minuses for me.
I'm not giving my grade yet. I need to think about these movies a little more. But a movie that I think
we know that I disagree with you about A Star Is Born.
You meant A Star Is Born and
Maestro.
Yeah,
I didn't mean Priscilla.
Oh,
yeah,
you didn't mean
sorry.
Priscilla. Oh, okay. All right. No, A Star Is Born is A+ for me. I love that.
I know.
One.
We disagree, but that's okay. We can talk about that during Maestro.
Yes, we could do that. We'll have we can talk about A Star Is Born, Tar, and everything, and Maestro. But I think we both give Anatomy of a Fall an A. It's a great film. It's an A+ Sandra Hüller performance.
And please be patient with me as I stan her for the next.
Yes.
I just need to like go through this phase, and I'll try to do it with elegance.
Yes, I think I'm going to stan her too. She is wonderful in this film, and she's always been great. AZ, where can people find you?
Find me at BK Rewind on Twitter, X, and then BK_Rewind on Instagram, Be Kind Rewind on YouTube.
And I am at Mortada_E on Instagram and ME_Says on Twitter/X. And this podcast, also follow us. The podcast is at I Am Picture Show on Instagram and Twitter. And until next time, thank you for listening.